coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome to our show and today's survey of the readings for the second Sunday after the Epiphany according to Series C of the three-year series lectionary. And the readings are Isaiah 62 verses 1 to 5, Psalm 1 to 8, 1 Corinthians 12 verses 1 to 11, and John chapter 2 verses 1 to 11. We begin with Ethan Stoppenhagen.
Time begins and ends with a wedding. In the beginning was the wedding of Adam and Eve, and at the last day, Christ, the second Adam, will be presented with his Eve, the church, formed from his side just as the first Eve was. Now, what does this mean then? I would say that it means that marriage transforms our understanding of the passage of time. And my wife, of course, has captured this when she said at our last anniversary, "How long have we been married? It seems like so much longer than that." So if it happens even on this basic human level, how much truer must it be on a spiritual level that marriage changes how we understand our experience of time? And so we find Jesus today at a wedding on the third day in Cana of Galilee. And his first miracle is one that we all know, the changing of water into wine. But as David, as you like to point out, the miracle isn't really in converting the water into wine. The vine already does that by itself. It takes the water from the roots, turns it into grapes, which are then pressed and fermented into wine, all of which takes a long time. The miracle is that Jesus speeds up this natural process and accomplishes in an instant what takes years to do otherwise. But what has Jesus actually done when he's performed this conversion of water into wine as his first miracle? Here, I think at the beginning of his ministry, he's transporting us to the end. He's showing us that we can actually experience a future reality in the present moment. It doesn't necessarily change our present circumstances, but it does change us, because now that we've experienced the good wine that is yet to come, we can tread a little more boldly towards that final hour. What is that hour? Jesus himself says to his mother, my hour has not yet come. And it seems like an odd thing to say, especially if we know that by his hour, Jesus means his suffering and death. But that figurative hour is the only time that actually matters. I think it's Dorothy Sayers who says that, you know, the cross is the only thing that has ever really happened. That's the only moment that matters in time. And it then transforms our understanding, our whole understanding of time. And so that means that even if the clock is marching us toward death, Christ will meet us there and walk us the rest of the way into his resurrection light. So this the first of his signs we read Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory. Every marriage is a manifestation of Christ's glory. And you can take that in the typical sense of John, where Christ's glory is actually his cross, but I think you can also get the transfiguration glory here as well. Because, well, there's no doubt that marriage is a cross. Sacrifices are made, desires are forfeited, things are given up. But for everything that gets taken away, Christ gives back and multiplies. You see that as children come crawling into the world. We see how more joy and glory is found in that discipline of child rearing than in any other exciting, thrilling, self-serving activity that one could find. And at the same time, marriage is transfiguring us. We metamorphosize from two into one flesh, and it happens instantaneously, but over a lifetime. So you see, we get two aspects of time, in one sense the fullness of time, but then the that Kairos time, but also the Chronos time. So if we begin, or if we end our marriage at the same, as the same person as we began it, then we must have done marriage wrong, because just as marriage transforms our understanding of time, it also transforms us.
That is very, very suggestive and saturated, Ethan. I remember it was probably a college philosophy class where people could think about time, right? I never thought you could think about time. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but that the thought was that if I can think about time, I can live in time better, differently, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So that started me on a lifelong interest in the fact that I kind of live with time in a pathological way. I get pretty anxious about time. Wondering what's going to happen. And so a good deal of my study has been, how can I be less anxious mm-hmm. About the nature of time? Now, here's what it is just, as I said, suggestive. You tie that abstract notion of time, the thing that causes anxiety, and when anxiety comes to full fruition, it becomes despair. You're saying that the common act of marriage somehow overcomes this movement of time towards disintegration.
Right.
How?
I think marriage, it gets us past ourselves, and gets us outside of ourselves. And it does that by forcing us to grow up. And I think there's this, perhaps part of the issue, the challenge surrounding marriage today, is that most young people, or people in general, think that there is a point at which their two paths cross, and that's where marriage happens. And each of them individually has to progress and grow and mature on the path until they get to that point where they can come together and finally, you know, get married, and then they'll have it all. Whereas what marriage does is it links us together at a point that we probably otherwise wouldn't expect, especially, you know, some people should get married early. Because it does. It forces us to reckon with the fact that there is now someone else who depends on me.
Okay, I'm going to cut to the chase on this one. So yeah. You're saying whatever version of love is at work in marriage, that is the thing that is experienced. And obviously we know it's not. When love is defined by Christ on the cross, it doesn't mean the same thing the way that people in rom-coms think about love.
Right.
It's this overwhelming, lovely feeling. So so this makes a lot of sense, because we're saying we live in an age that is filled with anxiety and despair. We also live in an age in which children are considered liabilities and marriage is considered restrictive. And so this is helpful. I know that none of this is going to get into a sermon. This is more Bible study material, but it's still it's still interesting to say, and what I think I'm picking up here is that what when all of time is mortals experiencing their mortality, which is death, is it possible for time to be something other than dying? Can it actually be building up, edification, growing, which is, you know, the language that runs all through the New Testament, that we're not dying. Yeah, that we're physically dying, but outwardly, the outward is not the only reality. And so what I hear you saying here, oh, I hate that phrase, but what I hear you saying is, we have short shrifted marriage. Marriage is a mystery. It is the mystery that is taking on our despair that time inflicts on us. And I think that, I don't know how you talk about that further, especially in age, but and maybe you just experience it. You know, what looks like death, what looks like crucifixion, is actually drilling down into the very heart and soul of life. So, and that if this is connected with a feast, and you know, with all that Joseph Pieper says about the feasting, and that the feasting is Jesus, it's important to Jesus that the feast not end, and that the wine not run out. And when you were talking, I was just thinking that he actually cared that that particular wedding continued to be a celebration of the marriage, and made sure that the wine was even better, which says, I think, volumes. I don't know what it says, but I'm sure it says volumes about what the gospel is and what Christ's intention for us are, that the other text must certainly speak to.
Yeah, and that with the psalm, you know, it picks up that banqueting imagery, or at least the centering of life on the home, where it speaks about how you will eat the fruit of your labor, the fruit of the labor of your hands, and you will be blessed. So what happens to the fruit of that labor? Well, it comes into the house, and it's prepared as a meal, and your children are like olive shoots around your table, and the man is blessed who fears the Lord. So I found this contrast interesting between the fear of the Lord and walking in his ways, and how that gets lined up with the prosperity and blessedness of one's family. That those things, usually, I at least in my memory, when you have the psalmist talking about walking in the way of the Lord, it always seems like a solitary path, you know, this adventure of the spiritual life. But what I appreciate about Psalm 128 here is that it recenters it again, sort of getting us out of the way, and putting the family table, the banquet, as the source of life, as the source of joy that keeps everything going. And you know, you could make all sorts of comments then about how that's been lost in society, you know, how things have shifted such that families no longer share meals together even once or twice a week, how everyone just goes off into their own little domain with their own little TV in their hand and has their own experience of life. But that sort of takes away about what happens at the table. Because it's not just that we're eating and, you know, being jovial and enjoying each other's presence. It's that wisdom is gained, right? You learn the fear of the Lord by being in conversation, right? By discussing one's experiences in life and hearing what other people say about that, and how those things get interpreted, and you know, if you will, it becomes in some ways the mutual conversation and consolation of the brethren there around the table and in the family, and that has a sacramental quality to it that sort of lifts us up and helps us see that our experiences of life are one meant to be experienced together, but also sort of give us or bless our families, not just bless us individually, but bless the people who we break bread with.
What I really like about the psalm is that it redefines prosperity. How do you view prosperity? And again, prejudice against children these days is how costly they are. Reducing a person's life, even someone who is yet to be born, into what they will cost seems to be a terrible reduction. Right. But the fact that it's possible for us to see our relationships as how you measure prosperity, and as you pointed out, we're distracted by other things which do not actually cultivate the prosperity of relationships. Now, I have to say, this cuts against my grain, because I really like my privacy, and I like my solitude, and yet I had four children, And so I'm agreeing with you that their presence in my life made me a different person, and not always was I on board with the different person I was becoming and having, you know, to drive them around and all the other things. But, you know, the Psalm, it makes a promise that these things are actually part of our edification. And even though it feels like it's tearing us down, it's not. And so again, thank you for this. I was not going to accent the things that you're accenting. So now I just can't wait to hear what you're going to do with the exciting other passages.
Yeah, I mean, it's lovely how all of them really do seem to fit together, you know, around this marriage theme. And sort of what stuck out to me, well, a couple things about the Isaiah passage was how, on one hand, you know, just how names get changed in a marriage, right? You know, my wife took on my name at our wedding, and, you know, it's the, you know, the announcement, you know, I present to you Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so. And so it's the same way for the marriage between God and his people, and his people are the ones whose name get changed from, forsaken and desolate to my delight is in her and married, right? And so it sort of shows us that when we go into marriage, there's really nothing inherent in us. There's no, I mean, we might say we like this or that quality about our, you know, about our spouse, but in the end, we're all just worthy of being forsaken and desolate, right? We are empty until we've been filled up by God himself. We're forsaken and barren. And what I appreciate about the Isaiah passage then is that it connects it to the land. And I really struggled with this idea, you know, that you will be termed forsaken and you will no more be termed forsaken and your land will no longer be called desolate. And I wondered what does it mean for the land to be married? What is it married to? Do you have any ideas? Did that stick out to you at all?
Well, not until you mentioned it, but I do recall a passage somewhere in The Lord of the Rings where the characters are walking through I think it's Minas Tirith, a once proud city that now all of the houses are empty because their prosperity led them to not have children. And it's such a desolate picture of, you know, you see the beauty, the architecture, the prosperity, but it didn't lead people to want more life. It led people to want more life for themselves, which meant not passing on life to the next generation. Mm-hmm. And over the course of time, that's what desolation is. And that affects, well, the same thing is being told now. We have all of these, you know, these universities with dorms that are not filled because there aren't any students, yeah. Right? They have all of these outward structures ready for people to occupy, but there aren't any occupants. And so I think we're living Isaiah right now. That's how I'm hearing that passage. But you have a different take on it.
Well, it just, in my mind, I was connecting it to husbandry, you know, that, and I don't know a whole lot about what that task means, but I understand it as sort of stewarding, you know, stewarding the gifts of creation such that they actually become fruitful, that they, you know, that they give birth. And so if a land is married, right, then it's, in some ways, you think of a farmer being or even a gardener being married to the land in a sense, because he's doing this husbandry task to foster more life, which of course is, you know, usually that task is what gets forgotten, like you said, in a society that's bent on prosperity. because there's no time for that slow work. And it's a slow, deliberate process, you know, to take that desolate land and to restore it to a fruitful and self-sustaining status is going to take years and with a lot of trial and error and challenges. And so it shows that, again, I think we get this transformation, right, between where it's instantaneous, where the name gets changed, but for the work to actually be accomplished is going to take a lifetime for the land and the marriage between God and his people to bear fruit, which explains why we're still here. You know, it's not that we're here to yak it up and complain about God until he finally comes. This is our opportunity for maturation.
I like what's happening here is that these passages together is taking, when we talk about love in the church, it's pretty thin gruel. It's a repetition of cliche, empty cliches, I say. And what your study so far has to say is that once you use the word love, now you're going to have to talk about the vertical love of God, the horizontal love of human beings. And then with the Isaiah passage and your image of husbandry, it's a downward love of the earth and the humus, the humble, the reaching down. It's inspiring in a way because you know, everyone's talking about there's a political right and a political left, and they each have their own version of what our relationship to the world ought to be, and they want to force it down. And what you're saying is, you know, if we would just begin at the bottom, that here we live here, and it's possible to love these things, and of course you don't ruin what you love, but you also use it. And so I just think it takes our cliche notion of God is love, which means whatever anybody wants it to say, and say no, that really is the thing that makes a difference. It really is that once we enter into this love, we are talking about a transformation of the self, and a movement towards building up rather than all this tearing down. So
just a quick word on 1 Corinthians. You know, what's a wedding without gifts? The wedding guests, you know, they wish to help the couple start their wedded life together, which is usually giving the things that help furnish a house. And so they serve one purpose these gifts serve one purpose, to foster the couple's life together. And in the same way, the house of God, in the house of God, the family is occupied or is made up of people with many gifts but one spirit, and all of these gifts work together to foster unity and lead to a confession. That's, I think we lose sight of that the spiritual gifts, you know, they're driven by one spirit to one end, and that is the confession that Jesus is Lord. And of course, then with that comes all the wisdom, the healing, the miracles, the prophecies. You know, each of us individually can't have it all, but together we come together and recognize that Jesus is Lord. He is the one through whom all of these things come into existence.
Now, I think, you know, with your whole comment on gifts, and I start reading that back into the gospel lesson, and the fact is that Jesus would not let the wedding pass until he gave something, right? And the wine is the harbinger of giving his blood, of giving his life, and that becomes not death but the life of the world. I mean, again, but what I really like is, and I think this is why preaching is so powerful, because it fleshes out the cliches. We cannot avoid cliches. Mm-hmm. What we have to do is, on a regular basis, flesh them out and give them meaning. And, you know, one of the common cliches people say, they roll their eyes back in a pious sort of a stance, and they say, God wants to institute a gift economy, right? And usually, yeah, you know, what they mean is they want somebody else to be giving the gifts, or it's somehow, you know, the rich should be doing more for everybody by giving it away. And here, I mean, I totally agree. I love the gift economy when I'm a recipient of it. But God wants us to be actively involved with it. And so all that you talked about marriage is this learning of us to be part, and to think that prosperity, the most prosperous place, is when people freely give of themselves and of their wealth. You know, where it's not harangued out of them in some kind of crusade in the church called a stewardship campaign, right? It's, I have been loved, and therefore I'm embarking freely on loving, and it's a move downward.
Yeah, and to pick up on your prosperity theme, I think what a passage like this can help show, too, is that, you know, prosperity materially, you know, it pales in comparison to prosperity in the sense of growing in wisdom and the knowledge of Christ, because that's ultimately what marriage is leading us towards, right? It's shaping us in the image of God's love, very, very literally, right? And all of those directions and senses, as you mentioned. And so that's when our earthly prosperity, that starts to pale in comparison, and we can actually commence this gift economy, right? That we can actually give of the things that we have received, because we have a greater treasure that we seek to pass on to others.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.